I'm Abby Lindsay Clark, and you are listening to Radio Lifestyle. Today we are chatting with the successful entrepreneur and professor Ryan Day. Ryan, it's a pleasure to have you on the program today. Thanks so much for joining us. Ryan, where are you originally from?
I was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma, left there when I was about 5 or 6 years old, and grew up predominantly after that in Chicago. But after, we lived in Colorado, Texas, Georgia. Wow. So we moved a lot as kids.
Yeah, all over the place.
Yeah.
What brought you to Spain?
Initially, in 2006, I came here to do a master's degree. Mm-hmm. It was a joint master's degree that used to exist between St. Louis University and the Autonoma of Madrid. And it was in English literature and cultural studies.
Great.
So I was here for that for 2 years and then left to teach in China for a year.
Wow. Been all over.
went back to the U.S. to do a PhD in literature. And then I moved back to Spain when I was writing the dissertation for that.
Wow. Fantastic. Interesting studies and everything else. That's great. Wait, let's talk a little bit about your group or Grupo Bang Bang. You are one of the owners, yeah, of the group.
Yes.
When did you start this project and what inspired you to do it?
As I said, when I was, writing the dissertation, I came back to Spain. My wife is Spanish. So I was working in Phoenix and she'd come out a couple times to visit. And we'd kind of taken advantage of the opportunity to take road trips around the U.S., especially around the Southwest. And we drove through California, Texas, Arizona.
Fantastic.
And I think for her, she realized that it was a much bigger food landscape than you tend to think of in the U.S.
Mm.
And, she's also a vegetarian, so the food that she was encountering, these kind of really rich, interesting vegetarian options, whereas in Spain, often things had been a little more difficult, I think, in the vegetarian food.
Definitely, yeah. When I first moved here, there was no way you could go and eat if you were vegetarian. It was impossible, I don't think there was one single restaurant back then. I mean, we're talking back in sort of 96, 97,
Yeah, it was difficult. It was difficult. And same when I got here in 2006, there was a handful of places around the city that were sort of go-tos, but nothing like now. Now I think, it's pretty easy to find great vegetarian food in Madrid.
Mm. It's become much more international as a city as well, which has, obviously helped on the gastronomic sector, for people to find foods from other places, other countries. So as well as, specialist foods such as vegetarian. So can you tell us a bit about Grupo Bang Bang and what it is? What is the group? What does it do? So that we can give our listeners a good sort of outline of it.
Yeah, sure. So, out of those kind of trips when she was coming down to the U.S., when I moved back to Spain, and I was writing a dissertation, was trying to figure out, how to make money, basically.
Hmm.
And I was teaching as an adjunct, but we both really loved the food that we couldn't find, in Spain at the time.
Yes.
So we started the Toast Cafe, essentially. Was just a place that we wanted to get going where we could do good American food, focus a lot on, breakfast and brunch, but also kind of have a cultural space where we could do things like, we have a bluegrass jam with some friends that come in. We did a poetry night for a long time.
Fantastic.
Yeah, we started a little literary magazine that I think is now in its third incarnation. But
brilliant.
But we've always done sort of literary events out of the Toast Cafe.
Lovely.
And that was really the heart of it. I mean, the Toast Cafe is really, the idea was to bring a place together. We could do good food, healthy food, local food, kind of pursue our ideals, through, this culinary format, but also to have this cultural space where we could make things happen that we saw were missing.
Yeah, definitely. That's great. And what year was this in?
2011 was when we started the Toast Cafe.
Okay. Yeah, so it's been going for a while now. That's great.
Yeah, it's coming up on 9 years in October, it will be.
Fantastic. And then you've got other places. So how soon did they follow after Toast Cafe?
That's kind of a funny story too. I guess I was for that first year or 2 years in the Toast Cafe, I was in the kitchen and Claudia, my wife, was working out in the bar quite often.
Okay.
And we kind of just got to a point where we realized, that if we were going to stay in the restaurant business, we needed to grow because I realized, my life was not going to probably be in the kitchen and she didn't want to work as a waitress. So we kind of realized, either we have to sell this and kind of pursue she's an actress and, I'm a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to sort of either sell that business and focus on our careers or grow so that we could sort of support the infrastructure and continue to make things happen. So we found Roll, mm-hmm. in 2013, and she fell in love with the space, really. It was a really beautiful space, very high ceilings, these beautiful marble floors. And we just kind of, at the moment that we were, you know, 1 foot in, 1 foot out with Toast Cafe, we decided to kind of dive a little farther in.
And
Roll was a great opportunity because the kitchen was bigger. Mm-hmm. We had the chance to start making more interesting food. We really got the chance to start developing our you know, abilities as entrepreneurs more so than, you know, cook and waiter. And yeah. And so that was the big jump. And after that, Slomex, I'm from Chicago, and Chicago has such a rich tradition of Mexican food. It's, you know, it's a really important piece of Chicago's kind of cultural identity.
Delicious.
Yeah. So I love it. Slomex was a way for us to sort of emulate some of the really great taquerias from Chicago.
Definitely.
Which is kind of sad, actually, because Slomex is not open anymore. We just transitioned it into a Toast Cafe. But a lot of the menu items from Slomex remain.
So. Yeah, that's good. It's important.
Yeah.
But at that time, Toast Cafe was going pretty well, I imagine, which is what made you take the plunge and invest in a second project.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you know, it's not, I think people have a lot of illusions about what Hosteleria, or, you know, the restaurant business actually is. And, you know, going really well means you're paying your bills, essentially. So, yeah, the Toast Cafe was getting by, paying its bills. And but, you know, you have to be a little bit of a masochist, I think, to be in the restaurant business. So, but, yeah, it's always been a vibrant space. It's always had a lot of people, you know, attracted to it. And I think it's got a lot of soul.
Fantastic. That's great. And one of the things I've really been looking forward to asking you about, because I always find this the culture fascinating of this world I'm going to ask you about. I understand, I mean, you know a lot about craft beers. And I see that Grupo Bang Bang even makes its own beer. Mm-hmm. Where does your interest in craft beers originally come from?
Geez, I guess it's just sort of, you know, time and place, kind of the zeitgeist. So I grew up in Chicago, or at least my young adulthood. I moved there when I was 12, but I was there through, you know, my university years and basically till I was 26. And the craft beer movement, especially, well, all over the U.S., but I think strongly in the Midwest, was just growing throughout that whole time. So we really went from a place where, you know, when I was 21, and you would go out to bars, and it was sort of the cheapest industrial beers were kind of the way things were. So you'd look at the place that had, you know, the dollar beers.
Yeah.
And I think that culture was really starting to shift, and you started to see these great beers being made in Chicago. Half Acre is a really wonderful brewery in Chicago that started to be identified with the neighborhoods. You know, early on, there were things like Brooklyn Lager. I think Founders is an early one that's actually now belongs to Mao, so that's an interesting connection to Madrid.
But
Founders was there
okay.
in Michigan. It was a big presence in the Midwest.
Interesting.
Goose Island was in Chicago, was one of the first. And it was just kind of like, it was a learning process where you started to realize that this I don't know, this kind of utilitarian beverage that everybody was, you know, looking for the cheapest possible form of could be this really interesting, artistic, well-crafted thing that was made with local products that had, you know, real people putting their sort of creative energy into making interesting versions, and, you know, as rich, if not even more so than kind of the wine world.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a whole culture, you know, the beer world, and it's something that, you know, sort of, it would be nice that people sort of would get more interested in that. You know, it's not just about just going to a bar and having a beer with your friends. You know, there's that whole culture behind it that I think it needs to be more appreciated in a way, as you
absolutely,
say, the way
absolutely.
The wine world is, you know.
Absolutely. And it's been, for us, it's been this great, because I mean, again, my entry point was in the United States, and when I came over to Spain, it was another thing that I saw maybe you could say missing from sort of the culinary landscape. But as, you know, we grew, we saw this beer world growing too, and it's given us such a great opportunity. You know, we've been to Leon to meet the people who make Four Lions. We've been to Santander to Dugal's Fabrica.
Mm-hmm.
We've been to Murcia to see the people who make Yaca. We've been all over the country, and
have
these really interesting young people who are starting these projects, and they're employing people locally.
Brilliant.
They're using local products. They're making something creative, and it's just, I mean, for all the talk of, you know, the negative sides of capitalism, which, you know, are obviously, you know, kind of pervasive these days, but this was really great to see this really positive side of capitalism that is doing these really interesting things and creating opportunities for young people to make something unique and vibrant.
Definitely.
It's been fun.
We've often heard the words, obviously, craft beer, but I wanted you to explain to the listeners, what are the real differences between your classic Mao and your craft beer?
I say, well, the first, well, first off, I would say, you know, that there's room for both. I think, you know, Mao, if I'm out on a Sunday or, you know, out with friends, there's a good chance that we'll be drinking Mao. And I think that, you know, that's great. That's fine. It's a good beer. The big difference, I think, is more in the culture. So, you know, the recipe for Mao, for instance, is probably pretty set in stone, whereas the recipe for a smaller brewery might change from week to week, month to month. They can do kind of more adventurous things. They can try out beers that maybe they'll make once. There's just a lot more space for creativity and experimentation.
Yeah, definitely.
And again, like I say, it's really interesting to see, you know, these are people who own the businesses locally. These are people who are employing people who are learning and growing. Young people to learn this this craft, and
yeah,
I think it's just it's a close culture to be a part of, and something that I think we should really pursue more and more of in our society. So
yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a fascinating world. I absolutely love it. I always try to, you know, when I go sort of to a bar that, you know, have got them, I always sort of try and experiment and try one. And, you know, and the explosion of flavors that they so often have is amazing.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yes.
It's a fascinating world. So
Yeah, they tend to be much hoppier beers. So you get a lot more kind of fruity flavors, a lot more interesting profiles, yeah. I think.
Okay, so as an entrepreneur, what drew you to the food sector in particular? Have you always been passionate about the gastronomic world?
I have, I guess. For one, you know, I studied for a long time, and I think that was part of it. So, as you know, as a student, you're always looking for kind of work, ways to kind of pay the bills as you're going. So I worked in, you know, I think when I was 16 or 17, I started in a cafe in Chicago. I worked at a Caribou Cafe, which is kind of like a local Midwestern Starbucks type thing. And after that, you know, I spent a few years working at a 24-hour diner on Belmont and Clark in Chicago, which is a very kind of, it was a very punk rock neighborhood. And, it was a neat place because, you know, we'd start at, you know, 11 at night and work till 7 in the morning.
Wow.
Oftentimes be asked to stay on until 5 after that.
But, oh my goodness.
Yeah. But it was a great, it was just such a great community. And you saw, you know, all the people from kind of the sort of punk rock area. And there was also a lot of just really interesting bars in the neighborhood. And so we'd get this transition to even towards like garbage men that would come in at, you know, 5 or 6 in the morning. And you saw the whole city through the kind of the lens of this place.
Yeah.
And I really fell in love with it. And also, you know, the cooks are, you know, complicated people, but they're interesting. It's an interesting culture and community. It attached us to a lot of the people in the city that you might not have had access to in the same way.
That
doesn't make sense. I'm sorry, but what am I trying to get at? It was just such an interesting place where all these worlds came together, I guess. And I really fell in love with that. And then afterwards, I worked in a number of other, you know, bars and restaurants as a cook, as a bartender.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, when I moved to Spain after I graduated from undergrad, many, many years after I should have, I came here and I didn't work as a cook. I started working as an English teacher while I was studying here. But I was always, you know, really interested in the Spanish cuisine, really interested in cooking for friends, really interested in kind of just continuing.
Yeah.
And I continued in China as well. You know, looked into the food and the food culture for the year that I was there. That was kind of one of the highlights of that time.
Yeah, I bet. A real eye-opener, huh?
Yeah, it was amazing. It was amazing. And then when we got back to Arizona, you know, again, when Claudia came out, to me, it was just the most fun thing about her visiting often was to be able to kind of show her these amazing foods in like New Mexico and Arizona and California.
Yeah.
And again, you know, people had so many kind of, I don't know what the right word would be. It's not really, I guess, prejudices, but against, you know, American food and American culture. And there's this idea that it's all kind of cheap and it's just not. You know, it's
food,
a really, really rich,
you know,
culinary country.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah. And I think it's great that you're promoting that because it is sad when people have this image of a country, you know, and it's food and they just think it's that and there's nothing else to it. And there's this whole culture behind that,
absolutely,
which is so important to, you know, to make people aware of.
Absolutely. And the mixtures in the United States are just phenomenal. You know, I mean, back to the sort of the waves of immigration that we've had and, you know, the influences from the Czech Republic, from Ireland, from Italy, but also, you know, from Asia, from
everywhere, pretty much.
African recipes predating a lot of that. The Native American tradition is still really strong, the Latino influence, and it all comes together in this just
Definitely.
amazing cuisine, I think. So.
Absolutely. So we've looked at your first two restaurants that you've opened, but you've got others, right? I just wanted to talk about the other ones that you've
Yeah,
got.
well, there was Slow Max and Village. Those two have, well, one has disappeared. Village Tap Room was a place that we spent quite a bit of energy and time getting going, and it was our biggest project. But unfortunately, it didn't survive the crisis here.
Yeah,
It was just,
sorry.
it was a very expensive rent, and it
Tough
was a place that,
times.
you know, we couldn't
Yeah.
afford to continue without operating. And then the Slow Max, which was our kind of homage to the Chicago Taqueria, has transitioned into being a second Toast. But as I said, we've maintained a lot of the menu, kind of the star plates
Oh,
from
great.
Slow Max and the Toast. So,
That's good. That's
yeah,
the important thing. You don't want to lose that. So
absolutely.
yeah, it's a good way of doing it, when these things happen. Oh,
Yeah,
tough
no,
times.
honestly, I mean, it's been a hard process, but I think we're actually happy to. I think we've been able to sort
Good.
of. We were spread a little thin, and I think this is helping us kind of refocus our efforts
That's
and
great. There you go.
yeah.
Something good has come out of
I hope so. We'll
it.
see.
So what would you say that the main differences are between the traditional home cooked American food and your home cooked Spanish food?
Be careful with that answer. Let's see. I mean, I love Spanish food. I mean, Spain, you know, it's I've adopted it as my home, not just because, you know, my wife's here, but also because I really fell in love with the
Yeah,
country,
you've
and
been
its
here a
food is a
lot.
big part of that. But I think there's the main difference is that Spanish food is very centered around good products and, you know, good chorizo, good cheese, good Iberian pork, good, and the flavor profiles are also very, they're not really about conflict, right? You know, you're going to put maybe salt, paprika, but things to complement the flavors that are kind of inherently there. Whereas American cooking, I think, has so all these influences coming, you know, from Asia, from Africa, from Latin America, and there's a lot more contrast, and a lot more. I mean, it's just a bigger palate, I think, that you're kind of cooking from. So I think that would be the main difference. Seeing that, you know, I mean, what is American food? I don't even know how to answer that question. You know, there's no way to even begin talking about American food without immediately diverging and talking about, you know. You know, Thai food or Mexican food or Indian food and how those have kind of influenced what we call American food. Whereas I think there's a little more continuity in what Spanish food is. So maybe it's just about, you know, I don't know. I think I'm trying to think of what was when I first got here. You know, you first come to Spain and somebody's like, the most exciting thing that people can show you, like, it's like the Bocadillo de jamón. And coming from a perspective outside, you're like, what? That's just It's just ham and bread. But after you're here for a long time, you actually start to realize the complexities of that and how good it actually is, you know.
absolutely.
When
And
so
all
that's
the
a
work that
different
goes
experience.
into creating it as well is, again, there's
Yes.
a whole culture behind that as well to be
Absolutely.
discovered and,
Absolutely.
appreciated.
Yeah, and then once you've gotten, I mean, we got to make friends with people who have, you know, Iberian pork farms, and we've gone out and seen the process and just the kind of love and attention that goes into that. And that's amazing. And I think for me, that's been a big contrast as well, the learning experience. I mean, in the US, unfortunately, things have gone more and more towards, you know, this industrial farming, industrial foods. And I think the culture has kind of embraced local. You know, small farm-based products, but what we're largely consuming is this industrial stuff, and the drawbacks to that are so massive. You know, in terms of the environment, in terms of health,
Of
and so I
course.
think in Spain, when you get to go out and see like these farms where these pigs are being raised, and it's just amazing. And I wish we could take more of that back to the culture in the US as well.
Yeah, it would be a good thing, that's for sure. Would you say that your establishment's dishes offer a good balance, nutritionally speaking, versus the image that the typical American food so sadly has, of fast food, and unhealthy or whatever?
I think there's a balance. I mean, we definitely have our unhealthy plates. I mean, we have a, you know, a burger, and I mean, it's hard to make the argument that chicken and waffles is, you know, a low calorie dish, for instance. But I think that, you know, it's okay to have those elements on your menu, as long as, you know, you're also thinking about the other options. And we've done a lot of work to make sure we have good vegan options. We are working with the Beyond Burger and things like that. We're doing that. We have a really good sweet chili tofu taco that we just put on the menu, which is a weird combination of cultural influences, but a delicious
Yeah, it sounds
dish as well.
interesting.
It's really nice. Everything on the new menu, almost everything, not everything entirely, but almost everything is available in a vegan form. So
we've made
a pulled pork out of jackfruit, which
Fantastic.
Is amazing. So there's healthy options there.
Definitely.
For me, I don't know. This is a really personal struggle as well, because I'm somebody who's been back and forth between, you know, overindulging in meat and being a vegan every year of my life. So, and I don't know where the balance actually falls. And I mean, I actually teach a class called Food and Literature, which really dives into these questions, where we're really looking at, you know, back to Shakespeare and Thomas More and Milton, and but through Jonathan Safran Foer, and trying to look at just like the way that, you know, literary representations of the way that we think about eating meat have changed over the last 400 or 500 years.
Very interesting.
And I bring that. I feel that kind of emotional connection to the issue when we're making our menu as well. I think it's really important to know. Ultimately, I think, though, as long as you can, I mean, I think there is room for meat. I think it's more about the way that we're producing it and the ethical sort of attitudes we have towards the animals as they're being raised. And if we can find a balance where we can, you know, kind of maybe minimize the intake and make sure that what we are eating is good quality, and that the animals, you know, are having a reasonably good experience in their life, then I think that, you know, there's a way to do it correctly.
I think that's quite right. You know, finding that balance. So
yes,
I understand that you put huge importance, obviously, into the quality of the food that you're providing, you know, you're serving, but also the personnel. How do you go about training them to offer the highest quality service?
It's trial and error. I think, you know, we've been doing it for a long time. We made a lot of mistakes. We still make a lot of mistakes. You try to make sure that the experience from the employee's perspective is an enriching one. So, I mean, I think that when they come in, if they have the attitude that they want to learn and they want to be a part of a growing, you know, industry, but also they can learn about beer, they can learn about, you know, American food, but also they can learn about local food production and meat. Some of the people who are, you know, making and growing the food that we're serving. So I think if they approach it with that attitude, then the training kind of takes care of itself.
Yeah.
So our job is really just to make sure that they see that those opportunities that are there, and that we kind of find people who are going to take advantage of them.
Yeah, definitely. That's a great attitude. So social media, the famous social media subject, it's obviously a luxury for businesses in today's world. But is there a particular one which you feel is the strongest from a marketing point of view for you guys?
I would definitely say that, you know, we've tended more and more towards Instagram. It seems like Instagram is the place where you're getting the most traction, and food is just, you know, inherently a visual experience, I think. So Instagram makes a lot of sense for food. We've used everything a little bit. You know, I think we've done quite a bit with Facebook, especially in the beginning. Twitter, not as much. Although I think that, you know, it could be used very well by somebody who had a little more time and creative energy about it. But yeah, for us, we've gone predominantly towards Instagram. We've got a lot of ideas about what we want to do in this year. The trick is making sure those ideas actually get enacted. But I would love to start making more video content, making more, recipe videos, trying to kind of...
That would be great.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of things that we could do to kind of extend the community that we've been building through our, you know, concerts and writing events to be a little more digital.
Mm. Do you have a community manager or anyone who takes care of all of that, you know, in particular?
We've had different people kind of rotate through that position. At the moment, we are sort of resetting. So I think we have... we've had a lot of conversations over the last month or so with people about, you know, who wants to kind of jump into that role. And we're not quite sure how we're going to do it yet. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, we do a lot of it on our own.
Okay, yeah. I wanted to ask you about the subject of bad reviews. I mean, if you've had any in the past, how have you managed these?
Biting your tongue, usually, I think. No, it's really frustrating. I mean, there's times, obviously, when they are fair and, you know, you can learn from them. And that's the majority. When somebody has a bad experience, they let you know, and that's generous and it's good. I do think there's a problem when it becomes so public and people don't recognize that there's a difference between you being, you know, a big international chain and you being a local family-owned business. You know, there's times when someone's sick and doesn't come to work. There's times when someone just doesn't show up. There's times when, you know, someone's having a bad day. And I think that people need to understand that as consumers, that, you know, they're dealing with human beings, and try to be as empathetic as possible when they're sharing their experiences, especially when they're based on one visit.
Definitely.
It's different to comment on a pattern of behavior. It's different if somebody's, you know, done something that's kind of outlandishly horrible. Okay. But when it's just, you know, your coffee wasn't quite hot enough on a given morning and you decide to put a 1-star review, I mean, you're really trashing, you know, a decade of somebody else's labor. And I think people should be a little more aware of that.
Definitely. Well, I absolutely agree.
Yeah. Private channels are great for that sort of thing. I think, you know, writing somebody on Facebook and saying, hey, just so you know, I have this experience. And oftentimes they'll reach out and try to help you as well. So
yeah,
I think that would be
definitely. So well, we've already heard that you're a professor at the St. Louis University, right, here in Madrid.
Yes.
How do you go about juggling all your different activities? You've got a pretty busy life.
Yeah. Well, you know, about 3 years ago, I really started teaching more at a full-time level. And then I officially kind of took over full-time last year. And I mean, that's my calling in life, you know, literature and literary studies. I mean, you know, that's why I did the PhD. And I just basically, I guess the short answer to your question is that my wife has for many years been doing all of the managing of the businesses and running of the businesses. And I'm really acting more as like a menu consultant at this point. So
great.
I help out when we're going to redo the menu. And, you know, I'm around from time to time, but my work is at the university.
Okay. So talking about these wonderful coronavirus times that we're living, but, you know, I almost don't want to touch on the subject these days, you know, but it's reality. And I wanted to ask you, I understand that, you know, it's hit business, it's hard, but especially the restaurant sector. Yes. How has your group cope with this?
As best we can. I mean, I think we've probably made a lot of mistakes and we've kind of, but you know, it's just, there's not a good answer. It's very hard to see how, you know, you can, you know, close the doors of a restaurant for 3 months, but continue with all the costs, the rent. So, I mean, for us, for instance, when we had the four didn't survive is we had almost $20,000 a month in rents.
Wow.
So 3 months is $60,000 that's going
that's
in
crazy.
While we have zero income. And that's not really reasonable to expect businesses to be able to get through that.
Absolutely not.
No, and for the landlords, you know, I mean, the impetus was really put on the landlords to offer a negotiation or to be, and some were willing and some weren't. And so it was just kind of a roll of the dice. And I've heard that story from a lot of people who own restaurants or businesses right now. So there's, I think, a lot of them have already closed. I think that, you know, we'll see more of that as we get to September and people realize sort of the full extent. And also, you know, people have had to take on just crushing amounts of debt to get through this time. And now that we're coming back in, you know, you've got a full staff. Your rents are likely where they always were, but your aforo or your, you know, your seating is limited to maybe a third, 50%, 60% now is coming up.
Yeah.
Which is obviously, I think, from a public health perspective, absolutely correct. And it should be that way.
Of course.
But I think there has to be a little bit of understanding from the government side of things, too, that you can't maintain staffing levels and rent levels.
No.
And expect businesses to survive.
Yeah.
So it's been tough. I think we will get through it with the three that we have. But it's all about September. You know, we'll see if kind of the world gets back to something like normal or...
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not just us. I have to remind myself of that throughout this entire thing. You know, it's everybody's in this scenario and we're all trying to figure out what to do next. So.
Definitely. Yeah. It's taking it day by day, really,
yes.
for everyone. Right. And
yes.
But I think you're right. I think September will be very much a telling time to see, you know, after summer, see what's going to happen and what the situation is going to be. So, I mean, now that we're sort of starting to live, you know, what we call the new normal, how are you finding that things are going today with your different establishments?
Yeah, so it's really different in each place. Roles, things are going well. It has a terrace, so that helps us, you know, have a more or less sort of normal flow of people.
Good.
It's at about a third of what it normally would be for this time of year, but given the circumstances, that's a good outcome. The Slomex, now Toast Malasaña, is just getting started. We've only been open for a couple weeks, and it's okay. I mean, I would say less than a third, maybe like a fifth of its normal business, but but there is people coming in, or there are people coming in, I should say. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the food's coming out well and people are reacting nicely to the beers, and we'll see. And the attitude of people has been really generous and good. So that's been nice.
Great.
And yeah. Toast Cafe, we haven't opened yet. So it'll be opening in September or maybe the end of August. Just decided in Chambéry in particular, you know, under normal circumstances, July and August are completely dead.
Yeah, of course.
So we're going to hold off until the fall.
Yeah, I'm sure that's probably sensible. It's just, it's coincided with a very difficult time of the year as well, as you say, because, you know, Madrid traditionally shuts down and everyone goes off to the beach or wherever. And so right. It's, you know, it's something that really has to be kind of looked at carefully, you know, whether you go ahead and open or whether you, you know, you hold off. So, yeah, I'm sure you're doing the right thing.
I hope so. Yeah.
So the other thing I wanted to ask you about is, you know, do you have any future goals and projects regarding your establishments, any new establishments that you obviously we've got to wait and see what's going to happen in September. It's something you couldn't jump into right now, but have you got any future projects that you'd like to share with us?
My future goals and projects are pretty much all writing related. So,
okay.
I've got a novel coming out in October.
Fantastic.
An academic work on Shakespeare that should be out in the next like 6 months or so.
Congratulations.
I've got, you know, other kind of writing projects in the future. I'd love to do, you know, some food related writing.
You should.
And in terms of the restaurants, we're definitely in just kind of wait and see mode. I have zero goals to open anything new at the moment. I just want to, you know, make the things that we have survive and thrive and do a little better. And and I think my wife feels the same, because, you know, she's an actress by calling, and I think she's ready to start focusing her energies in that direction as well.
Yeah.
I think what I want is for the restaurants to get to a place where they are sustaining themselves, that we can kind of focus our energies into the more creative elements of them, and not worry as much about the day-to-day operations. And, you know, I just want them to continue to be, you know, good parts of their community and continue to do the things that that we see as important, as we talked about before, you know, the focus on local food and the focus on locally produced beers. And as long as, you know, that remains possible, I think we're going to keep doing it. And I'm hoping that there's not a larger threat to that sort of that sort of industry in this moment. So.
Yeah, hopefully not. All fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Time will tell, but I'm sure we'll be fine.
Yeah, so. I think so. I am optimistic. I mean, I am optimistic.
Definitely. I think you have to be. And, you know, there's no reason why, you know, we can't all get back on our feet again and things go on, you know, and carry on working well. And
yeah, you know, ultimately it comes down to the customer. So, you know, you asked a little bit about the online reviews and things before, but I think it's also about, you know, kind of voting with your feet. And if people are coming into these businesses, they'll survive. If people are turning to the cheapest options and going to the chains, then we won't, you know. So I think it really has to be about what kind of world do you want to live in, what kind of community do you want to be a part of. The online delivery is a great supplement, but it's not something that's going to support these businesses. So you really have to get out, go in, be safe, obviously, but make them a part of your day and your life, and then they'll stick around.
That's great. Well, Ryan, thank you so much for coming on the program and telling us so many interesting things about your projects.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, thank you so much.